Today we will finish looking at Daniel chapter 11. As a new king of the north comes on the scene and further prophecies which will occur before Christ's return. Many people want to hear about prophecy. Sometimes prophecy can be really drawn out and a little bit long, so bear with all this. There is some interesting facts in here. Trust me, this was probably one of the most difficult things I've had to put together. And it's not an easy sermon to do, so I'm really taking some chances and risk here. But I will stick to what the Bible says and what our church believes. Today, we will continue on here and just to recap a little bit here on the fulfillment of verse 20, as mentioned last time, of Daniel 11. We will look at this again just before we get to this next verse, which is very crucial. So the Roman Senate decided to trade hostages. Therefore, they ordered Seleucus the Fourth to send his son Demetrius, the heir to the throne, to Rome. In return, the Romans released Seleucus the Fourth's younger brother, Antiochus the Fourth. When released, Antiochus the Fourth went to Athens. There were many rumors that thought that he was assassinated. He was not. In 175 BCE, after Demetrius was sent away to Rome, Seleucus IV was poisoned by his minister, Heliodorus, and some historians actually think that he desired the throne for himself, as you will see, but others believe that Antiochus IV was behind the murder, which wouldn't be a surprise either. So Seleucus' young son, which was another Antiochus, he was only age 5. He was put on the throne in his place. However, this minister, Heliodorus, was actual power behind the throne. And that brings us up to where we're going to continue on in verse 21. And we're going to be speaking about Antiochus the Fourth. Now, Daniel 11, chapter 11, verse 21 through 35, these verses speak of the infamous Antiochus IV, also known as Epiphanes, which means God manifest. So starting in verse 21, and in his place shall arise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. So with Seleucus IV dead, the rightful heir of the throne was young Demetrius. However, he was no longer available, having been sent to Rome as a hostage. So at the time of the murder of Antiochus IV was in Athens. However, when he heard of this, when Antiochus heard about this, his brother's death, he quickly sailed to Pergamum. Once there, he sought the help of Eumenes II, he was the king of Pergamum. And by flattering this king and his brother, he received their support and backing. So Antiochus Epiphanes, he arrived in Seleucia with a powerful ally. He thwarted Heliodorus' designs for the throne, and he became the co-regent, protector of Seleucus, the fourth infant son, which was also named Antiochus. Was only 5 years old. In 170 BCE, the younger Antiochus was murdered while Antiochus IV was conveniently absent, paving the way for him to take sole possession of the throne. Verse 22. With the force of the flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. Because of his ability to charm people and ally himself with them, Antiochus Epiphanes was able to overcome all kinds of threats to his throne. The Prince of the Covenant here is a reference to the Jewish high priest, Onias the Third. Now, he was the high priest at that time when Antiochus the Fourth came into the throne. Now, a brother, and this gets interesting, the brother of Onias named Joshua, who had become Hellenized and changed his name to Jason, made a deal with Antiochus the Fourth. See, Jason told him that he would pay Antiochus the Fourth a large bribe if he would remove Onias and make him the high priest in his place. So Antiochus the Fourth forced Onias out and installed his brother Jason as the high priest in Jerusalem in 174 BCE. In 172 BCE, Jason sent a priest named Menelaus to Antiochus with his tribute money. However, Menelaus took Jason's money and added some of his own money to it and bribed Antiochus the Fourth to secure the high priest for himself. Menelaus then returned to Jerusalem. He disposed of Jason, who fled for his life. So Antiochus the Fourth's double cross of Jason shows the true nature of his character. He was a really class act. Verse 23. I know I had some water here somewhere. There it is. Verse 23. And after the league was made with him, he shall act deceitfully. For he shall come up and be strong with a small number of people. Once again, the king of the north set his sights on the kingdom of the south. In Egypt, a 14-year-old Ptolemy the VI, Philometor, had become king. He was the nephew of Antiochus the Fourth, his mother being Cleopatra the First, which was Antiochus the Fourth's sister. Big family bunch here. So Antiochus the Fourth, he sought an alliance with Ptolemy the VI, seeking to take advantage of what he perceived as weakness in the Ptolemaic kingdom and gain Egypt for himself. He moved through Syria into Judea, into Egypt, with a very small army, so as not to arouse suspicion of his true motive, and seized Egypt. His cover story that he was coming to act as a protector of his nephew, Ptolemy the VI. Verse 24 of Daniel 11, he shall enter peaceably even into the richest places of the province. He shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. So Antiochus the Fourth pursued a novel plan for gaining the Egyptian-controlled provinces. He moved into parts of the kingdom that were the richest. Then he did something no other Seleucid king had done before. Antiochus IV spread around some of the spoils of his war campaigns to secure loyalty of the people. The historic book of 1 Maccabees states that he spent much on the public. It is even reported that he would go into the streets and throw money to the citizens that were there. However, this was only the beginning of Antiochus IV's plan. Using his cunning, he visited the Egyptian strongholds to find out what their power was. Verse 25, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. So in 170 BCE, when Antiochus IV felt secure about the state of his own kingdom, he decided to take Egypt by force in what came to be known as the Sixth Syrian War. He regarded Ptolemy VI as a weak ruler and therefore not capable of successfully waging war against him. Antiochus IV was able to move his army to the border of Egypt before he was met with the Egyptians at Pelusium, which is near the Nile Delta. The Egyptians had a large army arrayed against them there. So Antiochus, risking death by riding into the midst of the battle, he ordered the Egyptians to be taken alive instead of slain. By his policy, he gained Pelusium, and later he took the city of Memphis. Verse 26, "Yes, those who eat the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain." So Ptolemy the Sixth army, although very large, it was not able to withstand against Antiochus. In large part, this was due to the intrigues of Antiochus, who corrupted several of the Egyptian ministers and officers. This was one of the main causes of the defeat of Ptolemy the Sixth. Those who were in his confidence and possessed the secrets of the state betrayed him to Antiochus the Fourth. For example, Ptolemy Macron, also called Ptolemy the son of Dorymenes, had been appointed by Ptolemy VI as governor of Cyprus. However, sensing the young king's weakness, he deserted to Antiochus IV, who made him governor of Coele, Syria, and also Phoenicia. Interesting things there, right? Verse 27. "Both these kings' hearts have been bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. But it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time." So after he took control of these two towns in Egypt, Antiochus IV set his sights on Alexandria. Due to the intrigues of Antiochus IV, mentioned here in verse 26, the Alexandrians had renounced their allegiance to Ptolemy VI and had made his younger brother, Ptolemy IV, Erigetes, king in his place. I hope you all brought your sheet that I handed out last week. It shows all the kings. While at Memphis, Antiochus IV and Ptolemy VI had frequent conferences, sitting at the same table. Antiochus IV professed his great friendship to his nephew and concern for his interests. But his true plan was to weaken Egypt by setting the brothers against one another. Conversely, Ptolemy VI professed gratitude to his uncle for his interest he took in his affairs. He laid the blame of the war upon his minister, Ulias, one of the guards or guardians that was appointed to watch over him after his father's death, as he was the younger. All the while, Ptolemy VI sought to smooth things over with his brother Ptolemy VII so that they could join forces against their deceitful uncle, Antiochus Epiphanes. Verse number 28 of Daniel 11. "While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant. So he shall do damage and return to his own land." Again, the reason why these kings of the north and south are very important is because Judea, Jerusalem, was right in the middle. Anytime that they engaged, they had to go through there. So while Antiochus IV was engaged in Egypt, there was a false rumor that arose in Judea that he had been killed. This prompted the deposed high priest Jason to raise up an army. Remember Jason? Now he raised up an army of 1,000 men, and he attacked Jerusalem. His army captured the city and forced the high priest Menelaus to take refuge in the Acra fortress in Jerusalem. When news of the fighting in Jerusalem reached Antiochus IV, he took it to mean that Judea was in revolt against him. So Antiochus IV, he left Egypt. On his way home, he and his armies marched against Jerusalem. He commanded his soldiers to kill everyone they encountered. Everyone they encountered. Men, women, and children. Within a space of 3 days, his forces had killed somewhere between 40,000 to 80,000 people. Between 40,000 and 80,000 people. A similar number were captured and sold into slavery. Not satisfied with the slaughter, Antiochus IV entered the temple and guided by Menelaus, took the holy vessels, including the golden altar, the menorah, the table for the showbread, the cups for drink offerings, the bowls, the golden censers, the curtain that separated the rest of the temple from the Holy of Holies. He took the curtain, the crowns, and the gold decoration that was on the front of the temple. He took all the silver and gold, as well as the hidden treasures which he found. After appointing the Phrygian Philip as governor in Jerusalem. So he appointed a new governor there in Jerusalem. I'm just going to call him Philip. Antiochus IV, then he returned on to Antioch. This is only the first of many things that he was going to do to Jerusalem. Daniel 11, verse 29. At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the later. Meanwhile, in Egypt, the brothers Ptolemy the 6th and Ptolemy the 7th reconciled and agreed to share power. This annulled Antiochus the 4th's alliance with Ptolemy the 6th and caused the loss of control over the Ptolemaic kingdom. Because of this, in 168 BCE, Antiochus the 4th once again sought to go to war with Egypt. However, this time he would not have the same success as he achieved previously, which is spoken about in the next verse here, verse 30. For the ships from Cyprus, or Kittim, is also known as Kittim, the ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved, and in return in rage against the holy covenant, and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. Because they knew that he could not defeat Antiochus IV alone, the Ptolemy brothers appealed to Rome for help. In order to check the threat of the Greek expansion, the Romans agreed to provide assistance. The ships from Kittim here refer to the ships which brought the Roman legions to Egypt in fulfillment of this defense pact. History being fulfilled. Prophecy being fulfilled. As Antiochus IV and his army marched toward Alexandria, they were met by three Roman senators led by Gaius Popilius Lanus. I'm just going to call him GPL for short. Or just call him Gaius. They got some interesting names. But they met him in Eleusis, a suburb of Alexandria. There, the Roman ambassador delivered to Antiochus IV the Senate demand that he withdraw from Egypt. When the king requested time for consultation, Popilius drew a circle around Antiochus IV So here's the senator. He draws a circle around Antiochus IV with the stick that he was carrying and told him not to leave the circle until he gave his response. I'm sure Antiochus was shaking in his boots. So the king of the north was astonished at this display of Roman arrogance. But after a brief time, he said that he would do all that the Romans demanded. On his return to Syria, Antiochus IV tried to ease the sting of the humiliation he had suffered at the hands of the Romans by taking out his frustrations on the Jews in Judea. His armies encircled Jerusalem and then attacked. All those Jews who resisted were executed. However, the pro-Hellenistic Jews who allied themselves with Antiochus IV were left unharmed. Verse 31. And the forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Antiochus Epiphanes' army desecrated the temple. They stopped the daily sacrifices. On the 15th of Kislev, which was in December of that year, Kislev is the Jewish month, in December of 168 BC, the Syrians built a pagan altar over the altar of burnt offering in the temple and placed an image of Zeus Olympus upon it. 10 days later, on the 25th of Kislev, swine's flesh was offered on the altar of Zeus. Think about that for the Jews, what that meant. This was the abomination of desolation, setting up their pagan god, their main god Zeus, and then sacrificing swine. Now Daniel chapter 11 verses 32 through 35, now these verses appear to describe on one level the indomitable will and courage of the Maccabees, a family of priests who resisted Antiochus and his successor. On another level, these verses could even refer to the New Testament church with their references to mighty works, persecution, and apostasy. As my son was mentioning in the announcements about Tom Robinson's commentary, a lot of these things that I'm going to be reading now is from the commentary that is accessible for anybody to look at and is very interesting information. So starting with verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. Now I did find a few other sources beside our commentary and some of our booklets that mention these things, which I'm also going to be interjecting here as well. So after venting his anger on the Jews and desecrating the temple, Antiochus IV decreed that his entire kingdom should become one people, each of them giving up their own customs. The other peoples under his rule accepted Antiochus IV's command. Because of his flattering approach, many of the people of Israel also forsook the law and adopted his religion. Antiochus IV commanded a change to all the ordinances of God. No sacrifice were to be offered in the sanctuary. The Sabbaths and the feasts were to be profaned. And that the Jews were not allowed to circumcise their sons. Upon pain of death, they were commanded to profane the true religion so that eventually the law would be forgotten. Antiochus IV appointed inspectors to watch the Jews and commanded the cities of Judea to offer pagan sacrifices. Yet many in Israel stood firm and rejected the innovations of the king of the north. Now the time frame here kind of changes just a little bit. In verse 32, it's apparently dual in application, as I mentioned before. Now we're getting into some of these dual things. We all know that the abomination of desolation was dual. The type was when Antiochus had the altar of Zeus set up there. This will happen once again because Jesus Christ said it's going to happen again. So now we're into the dual stuff here now in this part of the Daniel 11. But what this is talking about is also, when it's talking about the people who know their God, the people who know their God, that key verse there, is referring to both the Maccabees and also the true Christians. So this dual meaning also serves to advance this story flow to the time of the New Testament Christians. So in Daniel chapter 11, verse 33, "And those are the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering." As we all know, the Christians instructed many, and they fell in death by the sword and the flame and captivity and plundering. Many Christians have been martyred since the days of Christ and the apostles. This also has a dual application, referring to what Antiochus Epiphanes did to the Jews. He passed laws that forbade the practice of the Jewish religion, as I mentioned before, under penalty of death. He was very cruel. Daniel 11, chapter 30, or chapter 11, verse 34. "Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue." Now as the historical book of Maccabees, the first Maccabees shows here, the decrees of Antiochus IV eventually led to a rebellion that was started by the priest Mattathias and his five sons, which included Judas Maccabee. He and his family had fled from Jerusalem to Modium when the Seleucid forces took the city. So there, Mattathias killed a Jew who was sacrificing according to Antiochus IV's command, as well as the king's officer who was forcing them to sacrifice. From this very first act of rebellion, a guerrilla war against the forces of Antiochus IV began. After the death of his father, Mattathias, in 167 BCE, Judas Maccabee defeated the large army of Antiochus Epiphanes' general, Apollonius. To make a long story short, because this was pretty long and I had to condense this down, there was a few battles back and forth with some of the generals. Antiochus IV, he left his general, Lysias, in charge of his son and half of his army, with instructions to attack and destroy Jerusalem and Judea while he went to Persia to secure more funds for the war campaign. He went to Persia to pillage and steal to fund this war effort. So Lysias sent an army of 40,000 infantry and 7,000 cavalry and marched into Judea. 40,000 infantry. Get these numbers for a minute. 40,000 infantry, 7,000 cavalry. He met the forces of Judas Maccabee, 3,000 poorly equipped men. 3,000. And they met near Emmaus. However, despite being vastly outnumbered, Judas' army routed the Syrians, killing 3,000 and putting the rest to flight. In 165 BCE, Lysias again sent the Syrian army, now numbering 60,000 infantrymen, 60,000 infantrymen and 5,000 cavalry, against the Jewish forces, which had risen now to 10,000. This time, 5,000 Syrians were killed, and Lysias fled back to Antioch. Judas Maccabees was, and his army were victorious once again. And because of this great victory, Judas Maccabees and his men were able to recapture the temple. Now this is important history right here. They defeated him a second time. They captured the temple. So the pious Jews cleansed and renewed it. They fixed up the temple. They got everything restored. And on Kislev 25th, remember that date from before when the desecration happened, on Kislev 25th, 165 BCE, 3 years to the date after the first abominable sacrifice had been offered, the new altar was rededicated and holy sacrifices offered. The Jews celebrated the rededication of the temple for 8 days. In memory of the Jewish victory, the rededication of the temple, Judas Maccabee decreed that the feast of dedication, called Hanukkah in Hebrew, was to be observed every year thereafter for 8 days, beginning on Kislev 25. And Kislev could be anywhere between November and in December. So that's how, why the Jews still celebrate Hanukkah. In 164 BCE, Antiochus IV's army was defeated in Elymais in Persia when he attempted to plunder the city for its gold and silver. He was still out there trying to gather some riches to pay his army. Soon thereafter, a messenger came from Antioch and notified him of the defeat of the army by Judas and the Jews. Terribly shaken by these events, he fell sick and became bedridden. Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, died shortly after that. A dual fulfillment applies with these verses here also to Christians, as they were aided by God's Spirit a little bit, providing their tremendous ability to remain steadfast in the face of martyrdom. However, part of that verse 34 again, the later part of it, is many believe that it's, that some false prophets started to enter into the church as well and started to teach and began the apostasy. And I'll give you two scriptures that you can jot down if you want to look at later. Acts 20, verses 29 and 30. And 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. On to Daniel 11:35. And some of those understandings shall fall, to refine them, purify them, and make them white, until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. This process that began in Christ's day will continue until the time of his return, to refine the character of Christians and to make them spiritually white and pure. You can jot down Revelation chapter 6, verses 9 through 11. Also Revelation chapter 7, verse 14. Now we're getting into the end times here of Daniel 11. The four verses that follow in Daniel 11, verses 36 through 39, to jump forward in time. As explained earlier, Daniel 11, verses 32 through 35 appear to concern the faithfulness of the Maccabees, who would not abandon God's laws for the pagan Greek ways. These are the same verses appear to be dual, as the group referred to in Daniel 11, 35 continues to the end of time, meaning that God's faithful people in the New Testament church, His church, are included in this. Daniel 11, verse 36 continues the storyline, but at what point? Since Daniel 11, 40 clearly advances the story to the end of, or the time of the end, it may be that the verses 36 through 39 apply to the whole history of the kingdom of the north from the time of the Maccabees and the beginnings of the New Testament church, continuing all the way up to the time of the end, just as verse 35 appears to extend the ancient times all the way up to the end time. And who was the king of the north during this period? In 65 BC, Seleucid Syrian was swallowed up by the Roman Empire. Therefore, the Roman Empire then became the kingdom of the north. Verses 36 through 38 appear to describe the actions of the Roman emperors and their successors, leading all the way up to the final leader of the end time, as we will see. While the duality of the prophecy serves to advance the time frame, Antiochus Epiphanes, himself being a type of this end time ruler, we might wonder why there are such major jumps to the future. There are some scholars that believe that Herod the Great actually fulfilled some of these prophecies. And it's quite possible that he could have, but this might have only been a first fulfillment, and at the time of the end, a dual fulfillment of these prophecies will occur. So it is a possibility. I'm just putting that out there as information. But there's many historical changes here now. As stated before, in 65 BC, the Roman Empire defeated the Seleucid Syria, becoming the new king of the north. Now, a few scholars believe that Octavius Caesar, Julius Caesar's nephew, later known as Augustus, as the king of the north, they look at him as the king of the north during his battle against Mark Antony and Cleopatra, the king of the south. Again, this may be a duality in prophecy that might be the case, but there is a future fulfillment of this prophecy. During this battle, in 30 BC, Octavius defeated Egypt. So, the king of the north and the king of the south now came under Roman rule. No more king of the north, no more king of the south. It's all Rome now. It's also interesting to note that the detailed early part of the prophecy seems to end before the first century and not to resume until the time of the end, which is referred to in Daniel 11, verse 40. Why is there a gap of approximately 2,000 years between these verses? Perhaps because there was no Jewish nation in the Middle East during this time. Think about it. After 70 AD, when Jerusalem was destroyed, Judea was destroyed as well. However, with the founding of the State of Israel in 1948, the King of the North and the King of the South once again have a significance regarding the fate of the Jewish people in the Holy Land. But for many years, there was no Jewish kingdom, so there was no King of the North and King of the South. But now the state is there again. End-time prophecy could not be fulfilled without the restoration of the Jews to their homeland. In the Old Testament prophetic book of Zechariah, we read that Jerusalem and Judah, the Jews consistent of the modern state of Israel, are at the center of the world conflict immediately before Christ's return. But this prophecy could not have taken place without the physical restoration of Judah, now named Israel, to some extent in the Holy Land before the end, time of the end. You want to turn to Zechariah, and we will come back to Daniel 11. In Zechariah chapter 14, starting verse 3, we see this prophecy about Christ's second coming. Then the Eternal will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. And in that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from the east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain shall move toward the north, and half of it toward the south. Then you shall flee through my mountain valley. Clearly, this prophecy is still for the future. The preceding verses show that the reason the people need to flee is because Jerusalem will once again be the scene of great turmoil. You go back to verse 2 of Zechariah 14. For I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished. Half of the city shall go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Now previously, Zechariah recorded these words here from God in Zechariah chapter 12, verse 2 and 3. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples when they lay siege to Judah and Jerusalem. And it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all the nations of the earth are gathered against it. So right there is talking about Judea and Jerusalem, not the nation of Israel, which we know the last 10 tribes are among us and other places. It's just referring to Judah. And the nation of Israel is the Jews. And Jerusalem is the capital, as our president made sure everybody knows about. So back to Daniel 11. Now verses 40 through 45 details event of the end times, where the European beast power of the north is ultimately brought to his end at Christ's return. Now the struggle continues because Judah, as I said, is present once again in the Holy Land. And the kings of the north and the kings of the south of Jerusalem can now exist again since the Jews have created the state of Israel. We can now understand more clearly why the struggle between the king of the north and the king of the south resumes at the time of the end, as Daniel says, at the time of the end. The verse continues to describe how the king of the south shall attack him, the king of the north, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, all symbols of military action. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. That's verse 40. Clearly, at the time of the end, another round of great turmoil will engulf the Middle East. Only this time it will be far worse than anything we've ever seen before. The fulfillment of this prophecy would not be possible until the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the division of those Arab territories that were part of it that broke off into the various nations of the Middle East today. After World War I, there was a few treaties that were signed dissolving the Ottoman Empire. They only retained Turkey, and the other Arab states came under the control of the British, the French, and some of the other allies. Great Britain had control of Palestine, and they allowed Jewish settlers to move into Palestine. This would eventually result in the nation of Israel forming 20-some years later. So who are the kings of the north and south now? Because they were gone. Rome swallowed up both to become the kingdom of the north and the south thereafter. We also know that ancient Rome fell. However, the key to understanding this passage is to realize that the center of the prophecy is the Holy Land and Jerusalem, the historic land that was given to the children of Israel. The kings refer to our powerful leaders that will come from regions to the north and to the south, invade for the control of this area, trampling all over Judah in the process. A century ago, no one could have understood many of the prophecies that are relating to this part of the world because of the Ottoman Empire. It ruled over all these places. But now, all these Arab states, they got their different independences from Britain and other, and from the French. The Middle East is completely different. This fact kind of helps us to understand God's word to Daniel at the end of his prophetic book, Daniel chapter 12, verse 9. God says, "Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed to the end, or until the time of the end." It would have been impossible for Daniel, living in the 6th century BC, to have understood the astounding changes that would lead up to today's complex Middle East situation. As we see things changing all the time, and very quickly. Doesn't take very long for things to happen. And because of that, we still really cannot truly say for sure what the two identities are. It's still working its way out. But the Bible does help us to understand what to expect as we read in the prophetic books of Daniel and Revelation, that another global superpower will arise at the end of this age. It's the time of the end. Daniel 11, verses 40 and 41. I'm going to read them together. "At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelming them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon." Now this passage refers or tells us that this king of the north, which will likely be a revival of the Roman Empire, the fourth kingdom that it was spoken about in Daniel chapter 2, in Daniel chapter 7, as well as in Revelation chapter 17. This revival of the Roman Empire will successfully counterattack the king of the south. Verses 41 through 43 indicate that in the process he will enter the glorious land, the Holy Land, Jerusalem. And he will gain control over and have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over the precious things of Egypt. This final resurrection of the Roman Empire, like the original empire, will be centered in Europe. It appears that we can see today in its embryonic form the European Union. We do not know what this final configuration is going to look like and what nations will be part of it. But time will tell us. We're watching it right now. I find it interesting today's headlines with Brexit. The UK is leaving this group of nations. And our president is actually encouraging or demanding that these NATO nations take care of themselves and contribute more. This may lead them or force them to build a stronger military, one that can be used by the beast-powered final revival to be the next world superpower. Most people don't think about that. When you see the headlines, they go, oh, he's being bad, or, you know. But this is all part of God's plan. God works things out many different ways. He will work it out. He works it out through the leaders of the world that he has appointed. This end time king of the north, which is spoken of in Daniel 11, then appears to be the final ruler of this end time. European-centered superpower. The same one called the beast in Revelation chapter 17. Edom and Moab will escape the retaliation by the king of the north, while Egypt will not. It thus seems likely that a leader from Egypt may become the king of the south, or that Egypt will be part of this group of nations representing this power. It's hard to tell right now because they really don't have the might and the strength, but I'll get to the king of the south here in a moment. Another thing that I like to look at from this phrase here in about Edom and Moab being spared is that for many years, God's church has believed that it could be because the place of safety for God's church may be located in these nations, which we identify today as the nation of Jordan, that many of the peoples there are descended from Edom and Moab. Not that they're exclusively just there, but they are. Final king of the south. As for the identity for the king of the south, we know that the Ptolemaic rulers from Egypt came to an end a long time ago. Yet there appears that Egypt, again, because it's mentioned, might once again be either the king of the south or aligned with other nations representing this power that will exist at the time of the end before Christ's return. In verse 43, it mentions Egypt. Now, Egypt and other Arab nations that rose up in this last century may configure themselves into a united group of nations. The dream of the Arab peoples is for Arab unity. The warring tribes of Arabia were actually first united by the Prophet Muhammad through a new religion, Islam. Many people have been trying to do that since. For a time after the 1952 revolution in Egypt, President Nasser was the inspiration for Arab unity, and many thought he would bring it about. And more recently, Iraq's Saddam Hussein thought the same way, desiring to unite the Arab world against the United States and Israel. We have seen a few Arab leaders rise and fall, trying to unite all the Arabs. Recently, it looked like as though this ISIS group was going to form the new caliphate, but it failed too. But they will not stop. This end-time king of the South will rise up to defy the West, striking out against the king of the North. Whoever the end-time king of the South might be, whether a popular figure similar to Osama bin Laden, a political leader like Saddam Hussein, or a religious figure such as the Ayatollah Khomeini, or the prophesied Islamic Messiah, Mahdi. Someone will engage in this final conflict against the West, possibly yet another attempt to bring about the long-sought Arab and Islamic unity. It's forming. There's many people jockeying into positions. We just have to watch and wait and see how this is going to develop. But it will come from there. This king of the South will unwittingly set in motion a cascade of events that will lead to unimaginable carnage as the king of the North retaliates against them before Jesus Christ intervenes to put a stop to it. The king of the North, the European-centered beast power, will be victorious. He will invade the Holy Land and overthrow many countries. He will defeat the king of the South. The king of the South is not mentioned anymore. Among them, among these nations, Egypt and the Libyans and the Ethiopians, whether it's the actual nations or the peoples, not clear. Continue on in verse 44. However, news from the east and the north shall trouble him, and he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. Daniel 11:44. Threatened by a major foreign military presence that's invaded North Africa and modern-day Israel, a military force combines to fight against it. Where does this great army come from? Well, it plainly says from the north and from the east. Looking at today's current nations, it looks like these would include Russia and China, two major world powers that often share a common interest, along with their allies and other nations from the Far East. See, a threat to the Persian Gulf oil supplies, real or imagined, could provoke such an action by these nations. China, with its population of 1.3 billion people, could certainly field a massive military force. You know, that 2-million-man army that's mentioned in Revelation. And with Russia's weapon technology, it makes for a very formidable military power to be coming against this king of the north. And whatever is left of the king of the south's Islamic forces may also join with them, as well as some other nations. After all, this is the setting for the stage for Armageddon, the ultimate, for ultimately Revelation chapter 16, verse 14 tells us that the kings of the whole world will be gathered to the Middle East for this final battle. So it ain't Russia and China alone. They're going to have some allies. There's a lot of other Arab states. You got Uzbekistan and all the other stands that are all Islamic. I'm not going to mention them all. You know, Afghanistan, Pakistan. There's a lot of Islamic peoples in India, even though it's mostly Hindu, but there's a lot there. They could join forces with China and Russia. But it seems likely that all these aforementioned Eastern powers will be engaged at some point. Virtually all remaining military forces apparently will be drawn into this final maelstrom of destruction to some degree, just as it happened in the two great world wars of the 20th century. Yet ironically, this is all part of God's plan, and absolutely necessary for peace to finally be established in this war-torn region. Daniel 11:45. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. Eventually, the beast will set up camp in Jerusalem, and all the nations that gathered at Megiddo will come at him in Jerusalem for this final battle. All this maneuvering, destruction and devastation, taking the lives of at least a third of all the peoples of the world. And this is the prelude to Jesus Christ's second coming. He must return to save mankind from this final conflict that otherwise would leave no human survivors. As he said of the time immediately preceding his return to earth, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. Matthew 24:22. But at his return, the peoples of the world will not automatically accept him. I kind of compare that to the peoples of this nation here. Not my president, not my leader. Can you imagine? Not my God, not my King, saying that about Jesus Christ. I can see that happening. The beast and his followers will fight against him, will wage war with Jesus Christ as he returns, will wage war against us as we return with Jesus Christ. Revelation 17:14. Jesus Christ will prevail and set up the kingdom of God right here on earth. These end times prophecies will occur just as the previous prophecies of Daniel did. We may not know all the details yet, brethren, which is why we must be alert and watchful of world events. But they will be fulfilled. There are many things that are happening each week, but we are so distracted by the other news that we see on TV that we might actually miss what's important. Keep alert, brethren. It is my hope that you will continue to look at these prophecies of Daniel, study them a little bit more, dig into it, and understand that these things which he prophesied happened and will happen. And most importantly, these prophecies are from God.